Good morning, members.
Good morning.
Welcome to Ways and Means. We do have a quorum. This is the call this meeting to order. We'll start with approval of the minutes. Representative Gomez, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes.
Thank you. Minutes have been moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. The minutes are approved. Thank you. First bill up today is House File 25. Representative Zalesnikar, if you would take the stand. The motion is to the General Register. I will move your bill, Representative Zalesnikar, House File 25, to be moved to the General Register. Please go ahead with your bill presentation.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson and members. House File 25 is a supporting women bill. Currently, the state spends nearly $24 million for sexual and reproductive health grants per biennium and receives over $1 million in federal grants, totaling $25 million. Without options, however, there really is no choice for women. For 17 years, there was bipartisan support for positive alternative grants. From 2006 to 2023, that grant was established in 2005, and members, you may not recall, but the House voted 112 to 17, and the Senate voted 53 to 11. And for 17 years, that held to be true. In 2023, however, House Democrats ended two options for women, such as the pregnancy resource centers and the maternity homes. This bill restores the $4 million per year as positive alternative grants, with $3 million for pregnancy resource centers and $1 million for maternity homes. The word choice implies options, and this bill simply gives three options to women, which existed for the past 17 years, prior to 2023. MDH grew in funding by 90%. It went from $316 million to $601 million. The pregnancy resource grants through the positive alternative is 1% of the funding, and 4% of the funding would remain in the sexual and reproductive health grants. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar. Member questions? Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Representative Zalesnikar. Kind of a weighty subject to hit right so early in the morning, but we must proceed. Just a couple questions. Representative Zalesnikar, if a woman comes in to a pregnancy center and there are symptoms of an ectopic pregnancy, what is the policy of a CPC for such a condition?
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. If I'm understanding your question, you're saying that whoever does the ultrasound or the doctor that sees the patient would know it's an ectopic pregnancy. Correct?
I'm sorry.
Senator Bierman.
Chair. Representative Lesnikar, I'm not saying that they would know. I'm just saying they are exhibiting conditions that might indicate that there's an ectopic pregnancy. What would the procedure of a CPC be in that position?
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. I would suspect that they would give the information that they know they're not, and refer them if they wanted to go to the hospital or to for further evaluation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar. So what you say, what I'm hearing is that they would refer to an entity that could address the medical care and even the medical care of a potential abortion being necessary.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Chair Torkelson, the question wasn't if they were getting an abortion. The question was about a topic. And so I think the person would get resources on whatever their question was.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar. So an ectopic pregnancy, if indeed that is the condition,
Mr. Chair,
that is sort of in the crosshairs here.
Are we in the Health Committee?
Thank you, Representative Scott. Resident Bierman, we're not here to relitigate what was discussed in other committees where this is the Ways and Means Committee. We prefer to focus on the financial aspects of this bill.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, I have a second question, if I may, please.
Representative Bierman.
And this is, I think, related to the financial aspects. I would ask Representative Zalesnikar, would you be willing to consider an amendment on this bill to delete lines 2.6 to 2.25? The 2.25.
Representative Zalesnikar, I don't believe we're here to amend the bill.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson, and that is the correct answer, no.
Thank you. There have been no amendments submitted to this bill.
One last question.
Very
please,
briefly, Representative Bierman.
So this bill could easily have increased funding for maternal care, which Democrats are always willing to support. Instead, it is about banning abortion and about whether we should move maternal health resources from an unbiased, medically accurate source to an unregulated care provider, which is what the CPCs are. Last question then, Mr. Chair and Representative Zalesnikar. How many CPCs are there in the state, to your knowledge, and how many will have to close if this bill does not pass?
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. And again, we're talking about ways and means, and we're talking about the $4 million being restored. That's what this bill is doing, is restoring funding that existed for 17 years.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. And maybe my question would be kind of just along that same line. You know, I think it's a question shouldn't be whether or not they close or not. It's whether or not if how many less women potentially would be served if these dollars aren't given. And I think that's how we should be looking at it, is how can we best allow women to seek out the resources that they choose to. And I think that's kind of probably the question, is whether or not they'll close or not. It's whether or not our goal is to have the best informed women out when they're pregnant or whatever. Thanks.
Was that a question, Representative Swazinski?
That's all. Yeah, it's more of a statement.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. We'll move on to Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zalesnikar. So when Representative Bierman asked you the question about ectopic pregnancies, you said, well, the doctor would do XYZ. So what doctor were you referring to when you said that? Are there doctors at crisis pregnancy centers
Gomez,
to advise women on their...
Representative Gomez, we're
yes,
not
sir.
Here to relitigate the health aspects of this bill.
Mr. Chair, I haven't seen this bill before, and so as a member of Ways and Means and a member of the legislature, I'm asking some questions related to testimony that was already provided in the committee. Am I not allowed to ask questions about the testimony?
Representative Gomez, I'll remind you that in the past, Democrat chairs have not allowed this sort of questioning in the Ways and Means Committee, and it's my intention to uphold that same perspective.
Mr. Chair, I guess it's my second term on Ways and Means, and my recollection from last term was that, you know, we sort of discussed the bills. We've had an entire relitigation of House of paid family medical leave, which isn't even a bill that's in front of this committee, at least twice in this committee, substantively on the policy, not just on the money. And so, you know, if you intend to, you know, we just heard a statement from Representative Swazinski. I mean, if you intend to hold us to simply discussing the narrow fiscal matters that are in front of this body, then I expect you to do so, regardless of who's talking and which party they're from, Mr. Chair. Also, Mr. Chair, I would love it if Representative Zalesnikar would answer the question, because we're spending $4 million of the people's money here. Representative Zalesnikar just referred to a doctor that's present in these centers, and I'm curious about whether the money that we're spending here is going to a doctor that would be present in these centers, which I've seen them around. They look very much like medical clinics. The signs on the front would lead you to believe that it was a medical clinic. They advertise free pregnancy tests very prominently. And so I'm curious about whether the $4 million that is being proposed here is going to doctors, as Representative Zeleznikar said, or not. Mr. Chair.
Please address your question to Representative Zeleznikar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zeleznikar, in responding to Representative Bierman's question about ectopic pregnancies, you referred to what a doctor's response would be to symptoms of an ectopic pregnancy. So is this $4 million going to crisis pregnancy centers to hire doctors?
Representative Zeleznikar.
Thank you, Chair. It's going to the resource centers, or it's going to grants. The grants are established and given out like they have been for 17 years. And so they may go to therefore the pregnancy resource centers, which have a mirage of things, from giving car seats to ultrasounds to family planning to education and support and or maternity homes. And there are there's a grant process that's been in place for that with very clear parameters of where the money goes.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up briefly, Representative
Thank
Gomez.
You, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Zeleznikar, as I just said, you know, these crisis pregnancy centers are all around in our communities, mm-hmm. and they advertise on the front of them very prominently free pregnancy tests. I've noticed them around the University of Minnesota, other places maybe where the young people are. I went to one of these crisis pregnancy centers when I was a teenager. And I believed when I went to the pregnancy, to inside it, it feels like a clinic. So you walk in, there's like a desk where you check in, you make an appointment, you check in. They were wearing like scrubs, the woman who was working behind the counter. And so when I walked into the crisis pregnancy center and I saw this sort of, you know, she had a stethoscope around her neck. I had every reason to believe that I was in a medical setting. And I took a pregnancy test that said I was not pregnant. I didn't know at the time that it was not the more accurate pregnancy test that you receive in a medical office. It was the kind of pregnancy test that you can buy at the dollar store. And so they told me I wasn't pregnant, and I was. And it was there weeks passed after that because I thought I wasn't pregnant because I thought I had been to a medical clinic, to a medical setting, and received medical information from somebody wearing scrubs with a stethoscope around their neck. And so, you know, this question, it's not, like, to me, it's not something that's immaterial to the bill. Because the question of whether you go into a place that looks and feels for all practical purposes like a medical clinic, and whether or not you receive actual legitimate medical attention from an actual legitimate credentialed medical professional is very important when we're sending the people's dollars out the door. So you said a lot of things that this money might be used for if it goes to these centers or to these maternity homes. But what I didn't hear was whether this money is intended to hire and provide, to hire medical professionals to provide medical care to the people who walk into these centers. Representative Zeleznikar.
Representative Zeleznikar.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. And from the experience that I've seen and the information I have, many of these physicians that work in the centers that you're talking about are not paid and are volunteers. They are credentialed. And from the standpoint of licensed, going into these places are not saying they're a medical clinic. They're a resource center. The grants that go to sexual and reproductive health grants, to my knowledge, they're not licensed either. They're not a licensed setting. A clinic, a medical clinic, is licensed. A hospital is licensed. That's not what this is for. And neither grant on either side is a license setting.
Representative Joaquin.
Mr. Chair.
I've allowed you great leeway, Representative Gomez.
Just one quick question.
Very quick.
Thank you, Representative Zeleznikar. So are these centers required to have medical professionals present at all times to provide attention to people who walk in the door or not?
Representative Zeleznikar.
Chair Torkelson and Representative, the staffing of how they, when they, the parameters of staffing is different in every setting depending on services that are being provided. So if somebody's having an ultrasound, services match scope in places of both grants of scope of what your practice is that you're doing.
So that's a no. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson and Representative Zeleznikar. I did listen to the testimony in the other committees, and I will try to stay on the money thing, but it's hard because it's the whole bill is written very vaguely about how the oversight of these grants will happen. Surprised you leave so much leeway for the commissioner, but, you know, folks love to use the word waste, fraud, and abuse around here, almost to the point where I think it's a single word. But I'm wondering what you expect the grant, the commissioner, to oversee and put in parameters around these grants, because it is $4 million a year ongoing. It's actually taking money away from the work that the department is doing. And you're starting a program that's never been around before, and that's these pregnancy homes that I'm curious to see, is there more than five people in these pregnancy homes? Because then I think they have to be licensed. How does it work with rent? And can a woman, if she so decides to, let's say, adopt or has a medical emergency and ends up losing the child, or they just kicked out the next day. Just wondering about the oversight for these grants, because it seems to be very loose, and I know folks are worried about that. So maybe you could tell me a little bit more about the grant management. Does the nonprofit, seems to be this nonprofit's okay to give money to, but others aren't. Does this nonprofit have to provide their 990s, or what oversight do they do on the money going out the door?
Representative Zeleznikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. I'll give members a refresher because for 17 years this happened. So the statement that maternity homes never received money is not accurate. These positive alternative grants were used for resource centers and maternity homes for quite a few years. Right here in St. Paul is where it first started. In fact, I looked at the agreements. The grant agreements had evaluation of the program. Wilder Foundation was a foundation that did these grant evaluations. They would establish if there was, and I talked to one who said, look, I'm pro-choice, but they did a fantastic job of doing car seat safety, education, big fan. They audited the entire thing. There was a system, and there has been 17 years a system where they have an outside independent audit by foundations like the Wilder Foundation to make sure all of the standards are met to questions that you've asked, make sure that they're helping guide women with the questions that they have.
A very brief follow-up, Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. Representative Zeleznikar, watching the other two hearings when you were asked about those homes, those weren't given grants. It was just the pregnancy centers. So I'm particularly asking about the homes and how they will be audited and looked over. And if a woman does miscarry and lose the child, do they get kicked out the next day? Because we're providing, it says you have to provide the rent for free. So it seems like a lot of control over a person's lives that they might not seek medical care or be worried about losing the place that they're living right now. So I'm asking about the rent part and the home part. Because from my understanding, the grants have not been given to those before.
Representative Zeleznikar.
Chair Torkelson and Representative, well, that's not accurate because Star of the North in Duluth received a grant and was in the middle of its grant process when the grants were pulled in 2023. So that's not an accurate statement. Secondarily, there's been third-party audits in the grant for grant recipients that it's part of the grant language where there's an evaluation of the program by an outside entity, and that has existed to make sure that happens. Thirdly, on the question, would they be kicked out? No. I have toured several maternity homes, and that's not the case. They would have access to care, and nobody's kicked out.
Representative Cortez Batum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Zalesnikar. I appreciate the opportunity to hear this bill this morning, but I have some really deep concerns about this proposal for spending $4 million of the taxpayers' money on an annual basis to unregulated, unlicensed programs that purport to provide care for women. I'm curious. It doesn't look like this bill went to the Fraud and Agency Oversight Committee. Is that correct?
Representative Cortez Batum, I believe that is correct, and there's no reason for it to go to that committee.
If I may, Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Thank you. The reason I ask is because, you know, if we are working to root out fraud and waste and abuse in every area of our state government, it would seem to me that the Republicans would want to make sure that $4 million annually of a program that they're hoping to stand up, of an unregulated, unlicensed program all across the state, we would want to do our due diligence and ensure that there are pieces of the bill that actually prevent fraud. Because the best way to stop fraud is to prevent it. But there's nothing in this entire bill about fraud. There's nothing in the bill about how these privacy policies and procedures will be enforced. There is no information in the bill about what the penalty will be if these the privacy policies and procedures are not followed. This is private medical information, Mr. Chair. This is unbelievable. That the author has not done her due diligence in ensuring that people's medical information is not made public without any sort of enforcement. There's nothing in here, as to what Chair Joachim said, about 990s, making sure that the places that are opening themselves up to women in a very vulnerable state are getting protection and care without potentially being taken advantage of. And I'm curious, Representative Zalesnikar, why don't you have any of the enforcement mechanisms in here to determine what may happen to these centers? Are they at loss? Are they at potential risk of losing that grant if they don't follow these privacy policies and procedures? I'm just wanting a little bit more insurance for the people of Minnesota that their dollars are being spent wisely.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson and Representative. Minnesotans for 17 years had exactly what you're saying. There's a third party that legitimizes the work of the grant. That is the stopgap protections for taxpayers. There has not been one fraud issue in 17 years. And that's because there is a third party audit that providers have participated in through the Wilder Foundation and others that have acknowledged success, that have acknowledged successful outcomes and that the standards have been in place. As far as unregulated licensed, neither one of the, on either side, whether it's the sexual reproductive health grants or the positive alternative grants, are licensed centers. They're not a clinic, and nobody's saying they are, and they're not a hospital. It doesn't mean there's not licensed physicians that are in either one. And that is common knowledge. And there's not licensing and the sexual and reproductive health grants either. And I'm not sure what their system is for evaluation from third-party audits, but I can tell you on this, for 17 years, there was a system in place for audits. I've looked at it. I've seen the agreements, and they exist.
Representative Kosnick.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Follow-up.
That was a very lengthy statement, very briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to ask a detailed question of the representative presenting her bill to us today. Can you confirm for the people of Minnesota that in line 3.15, where it says that privacy policies and procedures will not be made public or shared with any other agency or organization without the women's written consent. Does that include the federal government?
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson, Representative. Standard HIPAA practices are in place in these centers, absolutely, for data protection and for privacy. Yes.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning to the committee. I'd just like to highlight my experience with one of these centers, and I appreciate the bill being forward. I think the funding that's being asked is to supplement a lot of private donations that are support a lot of the work that these centers do. I don't think anybody is required or mandated to utilize these centers, but they are a great resource. And I was invited to one in Apple Valley to learn about one of the programs that they do. And if you could just confirm, because I think the answer is yes, there's a program called the Good Fathers Program, and it helps dads that are experiencing an unexpected pregnancy or maybe an unplanned pregnancy. And just, you know, kids don't come with a owner's manual. You got to figure it out as you go. And you know, as a father of two, I remember the days well, 18, 17 years ago, that it can be a little stressful. And the program that was provided, this Good Fathers Program, they had a graduation, grilling with dads and the graduates, grilling with grads that graduated from this, I think it's a 8-session, once a month course that helped provide services and just some education and support for dads and their families, their partners, as they become dads, and how to handle the stress, how to plan and goal set, and some stuff. But looking at the bill, line 2.27, for programs and services that support, encourage, and assist pregnant women in carrying their pregnancies, and it goes on. Is this the Good Fathers type program, is that something that would be included in one of these centers, or is this something that they would have to privately fund for? I think it's included, but if Mr. Chair.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Yes, there's several different programs like this that are set up in these positive alternative grants that are on education. Education for nutrition, for meal planning, for gardening, for parenting. Opportunities to get car seats and clothing and diapers and supplies and basically to have access to education for, you know, making sure that if they have questions with other peers and educators to ask questions and have a place for that. So, yes.
Representative Chair, if I could just voice my support for this bill. I think it's a minimal amount that we can do as a state to help encourage strong families, parents, moms, and dads to face the challenges, but oftentimes well overshadowed by the joys of becoming parents. And so I appreciate the bill, and I think it's something that we should support.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just point out that starting in line 3.12 to the end of the page and on page 4, line 4.1 through 4.3, there is an entire privacy protection section, including Chapter 13 protections. It is very similar to many other things that we have seen through the legislature, so those protections are there. I really wish everybody would read the bills before they come to committee. It would be helpful. The other thing I would say, since I am on the Fraud Prevention Committee, is that the Office of Grant Management, as we know, is supposed to be training best practices for all of the state agencies. Whether the state agencies pay attention or not, I'm not sure. We still have a lot of work to do in the Fraud Committee to figure that out. But the Department of Health is supposed to be following, and I do say they're supposed to be following because I sometimes wonder, the Office of Grant Management policy and grant management. And so all of the things that have been questioned today are supposed to be best practices followed by the Office of Grant Management when they train all of the departments. So all of that is already in place, whether it's explicitly laid out, it is laid out in law in other places, Representative Zelenzikar. So yes, the Department of Health, before they issue these grants, should be looking at all of the things. In fact, we had Deed come before us last Monday, and they looked through 990's audited financial reports. They looked at ratios to make sure that they had capacity for these grants. And I'm hoping that the Department of Health does the same thing. Deed does a fantastic job at actually looking at grants. So if the Department of Health is following OGM's recommendations and training, they will be doing all of those things. We are yet to hear from them. I know we had the commissioner, whether she'd be an interim or whatever, commissioner come once, Commissioner Gandhi came. We're waiting for her to come back, but the Department of Health is supposed to be following all those recommendations. So I would just point those two things out. The last thing I would say really quickly is on line 2.17 and 2.18, it says very clearly that if a woman's life is in danger, that they should be, as in an ectopic pregnancy, they should be going to a medical doctor. And I would hope that all of those things would be happening. They should be happening if they can determine that they have an ectopic pregnancy. They should be going to an emergency room immediately, because that is a life-threatening situation. And they certainly want to save the life of the mother and the baby. And in that case, the baby's life cannot be saved because it's not a viable pregnancy. It is not an abortion. It is a life-saving procedure. Ectopic pregnancies are not considered a viable pregnancy. So those are just a few of the answers that I would have, Representative Zelenzikar, in my many years. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to point out that same section to Representative O'Neill on the data. The bill did come to our committee. There was a full vetting. And I want to point out on line 3.24, the reference there, the 144.291 to 144.298, that is the Minnesota Health Records Act. And that is what governs every single health record in the state of Minnesota. And if you're concerned about data breaches, maybe we need to look at Planned Parenthood, who had a big data breach in September of 2024, where names and addresses of patients were hacked into.
That's unfortunate.
So since it was brought up, Mr. Chair, thank you for the levity there.
Thank you. Members, seeing no further discussion on this bill, I renew the motion that House – did you want to close, Natalie? Representative Zelenzikar.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. And members, this is a bill to restore 17 years of bipartisan work, 17 years of giving women options so that they have choices to make for their individual health and their individual life. And that's all this bill does, is give them three options and services available to them. And it was bipartisan for 17 years, and I believe it can be bipartisan again. Thank you.
Thank you. I renew my motion that House 25 be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
You're on your way to the general register, Representative. Thank you. Bill is passed. We'll move on then to House File 25.
No, four.
Four. Oh, sorry. Not reading my script well this morning. House File 4. Welcome to committee, Representative Johnson. I will move House File 4 before the committee and move to come before the committee and move that be placed on the general register. I'm going to ask you to move over one seat, Representative, so I don't have to crane my neck. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you. This seat's much warmer anyway. Have some cookies up front there in case anybody gets hungry during the presentation. What's that? Well, it's up to you. So I do have, thank you, Chair, members. I do have an amendment here to the bill.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, I'll move that the DE amendment to House File 4 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Your DE is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. thank you, Chair, Chair Ways and Means Committee members, for allowing me to the opportunity to present House File 4 this morning. House File 4 is a simple, fiscally conservative bill. If passed by us and by voters, it will ensure that a portion of any large surplus will be sent back to the taxpayers responsible for funding that surplus. Today's hearing will be the bill's fourth committee hearing. We've had excellent discussions during those hearings. A common question I keep receiving is, what if Minnesota has a large surplus, the legislature sends money back to the taxpayer, and soon after we are facing a budget shortfall? This bill addresses that concern by providing the legislator a 5% revenue surplus window to retain and help cover any future said deficit. We also have safety nets addressing that concern, for example, the budget reserve account. This bill does only one thing. It ensures that a portion of any large surplus will be sent back to the taxpayers responsible for the funding of that surplus. And I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative. I don't see any questions. Oh, Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, I do have questions. I'll just pause for a second to see if there's anyone else on my side who wanted to speak to it, because it looks like there are a couple. But I do have questions, but I'll defer to them if that's okay with you.
That's okay with me, Representative Stevenson. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. So we discussed this in the Tax Committee, but we will again here today, I guess. this bill requires, you said in your opening statement that this bill would require that we return it to, quote, the taxpayers who are responsible for the surplus. As we discussed in taxes, this only includes Minnesotans who have income tax liability and pay homestead property taxes, and businesses who pay property taxes. And so that just completely ignores the fact that about a quarter of our state's revenues come from sales taxes, and everybody pays sales taxes, whether they have that kind of tax liability or not. So Representative Johnson, have you done anything in the DE to address those concerns about excluding low-income seniors, low-income working families, people who rent from these, and people who pay sales taxes, of course, which is everybody, from these refunds? Have you done anything to address those concerns that we discussed in the Tax Committee?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Yes, I have spent time thinking about that. Again, this bill goes back to the people who, the money will go back to the people who actually did pay taxes or to result in the surplus. The question is regarding sales tax. From my experience with sales tax, it would be very, very difficult to try to track down those who paid and contributed to the sales tax. I know when I buy a product, or if people have service done with me, we don't turn that information into the government or the state. We just say how much we've collected, how much the tax is. So I have not heard how you would track down people who have paid sales tax. And the other question is, what about all the people that come to the Mall of America? What all about all the tourism that comes in here and spends money here and does sales tax? How would you track them down? How would you send the money off to them? So what this does is this identifies the people who have paid sales or have paid property tax or income tax as a way to provide the money back.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So agreed, it's difficult potentially to directly track individual consumers' sales taxes that they've paid in the previous year. But, previous refunds, the Jesse checks, I believe, were structured as a sales tax refund. It's not impossible. And so the idea that what we would do when we encountered something difficult is say, okay, too bad. They're just cut out. All those people are cut out. So if you're a married couple and you're living only on Social Security benefits in Minnesota, you don't have income tax liability because we completely exempted 80% of Minnesotans from Social Security tax in our 2023 tax bill. And so those are some of our lowest income seniors who are struggling to make ends meet. and you're saying that we would do an automatic cut and send that back to, quote, the taxpayers responsible for the surplus, but not that family. Not that senior couple who's living on Social Security and is renting an apartment. They would get nothing. So then what about that's your answer to the sales tax question, which I think, you know, if this were a serious item that we would really want to address that. But, you know, this is going to road to nowhere. Representative Johnson on the property tax issue. So, as you may know, renters receive property tax refunds in Minnesota based on their income because renters pay property taxes. They pay it through their rent. So there's an assumption built into the property tax refund for renters that 17% of the total cost of rent goes to property taxes. They don't themselves have property tax liability, but they certainly pay into the system. And so, you know, and again, a lot of our lowest income Minnesotans are living in rental property, and this completely cuts them out. Did you do anything to address that issue that we discussed in the tax committee in the interim between that hearing and this one, Mr. Representative Johnson, to address the issue around property tax payments that happen through rent?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. This bill is designed to send the money back to those who paid income tax and those who paid property taxes directly in. So there is currently not in there a way to redistribute it to others.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you call it redistribution, but there are vast swaths of our state who would be omitted from receiving these tax refunds. So that's a different characterization, but I just want to say again, if you're living on Social Security, if you're a couple living on Social Security, you get nothing from this bill. If you're renting and you're a low wage worker and you have a kid, you're probably getting nothing from this bill. If you know, you can work full time for minimum wage in the state of Minnesota and make $23,000 a year. If you take off the standard deduction and you have a couple of dependent exemptions, then you have no tax liability. Those people, however, do pay taxes, and they do pay like a significant portion of their income in sales taxes, which you've completely omitted from this. So, you know, I think we'll talk kind of more about some of the ways that this bill really ties our hands as policymakers, makes it so that we cannot react to emergent situations that we have to deal with as people in charge of a state budget. But just, you know, for the purposes of kind of like helping out Minnesotans who need it the most, this does almost nothing. Who it does help, though, who could get a refund from this, not those low-income seniors, not that low-income working family, but a business that pays property taxes could receive a check from the state of Minnesota under this bill. And I have real problems with that, because I think talk about picking winners and losers. And you're picking a corporation that pays business property taxes over an elderly couple living on Social Security or a low-income family struggling to make ends meet, all of whom are taxpayers in various ways. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I won't go down the tax road because Representative Gomez can walk circles around me on that and probably has forgotten more than I'll ever know about taxes. But just a reminder, too, I think the reaction to what you said is that 30% of our general revenue comes from sales taxes. So just because somebody's not paying property tax and not paying an income tax because they're a senior living on Social Security does not mean they're contributing to our economic success in our state. So I think that was one of the things that makes us a little grumpy on this side of the aisle. So I know you've done some work, and thank you for the DE-2, and maybe, but reading it, it still doesn't quite answer my question or protect the general fund, the budget reserve, when it comes to what happens in 16A.152. And those are the lovely buckets I keep talking about because, you know, I work in the education realm and I serve here and worry about our funding our schools a lot and also had kids in school back in 2005 when we were struggling as a state with our economy. And our schools, we borrowed from our schools. So currently, and hopefully from here on forward, thanks to the budget, the reserve account we set up, we have a what they call a 90-10 split in education. So you get paid, the schools get paid 90% of their funds the first year and a cleanup 10% the second year. But in 2005, that went down to 80-20. 2011 got a little worse, went down to 70-30. And then 2012, 60-40, which took districts years to climb out of that hole, also because they had to take out low-interest loans to pay their folks, to pay their bills. And we never want to get back there again. But this bill would put us right back there again. Because you have, I know you tried to address the budget reserve account, but the way it's drafted, I worry because on line 1.15, these the money that goes into that account is not considered a projected expenditure. So, because it says projected expenditures shall not include any amount by law to be set aside in the budget reserve account, but nothing in this section shall be construed to prohibit the legislature from allocating projected revenues. Doesn't mean they have to.
Representative
Dunn. The way I'm reading this means that we don't have to put the money into the budget reserve if there's a surplus first, which is how our law does it now to make sure we have a rainy day fund, to make sure that we have a budget reserve account just in case, let's say, the federal government takes away all our MA costs. And it doesn't require us to put the money in the funds to pay back our schools if we tend to borrow on the backs of our children. So I'm just misreading it, might have to have nonpartisan staff. Does this require us to put money first out of the surplus, if it's over 105%, into that general reserve account? Or does it give it a, oh, you can if you want?
Who would like to take that question from nonpartisan staff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Joachim, I think I read this as the money, if there was a positive difference between expenditures and revenues, that first a portion of it would go to the tax relief fund, and then after that, if there was a surplus, then the budget reserve and the other things in statute 16A.152, I think, would be applied. So I think money still could go into the budget reserve if there was a surplus left over.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson. So, Representative, it sounds like you made the bill worse because we're saying that we're going to pay any surplus back because the debts we owe our schools aren't considered projected expenditures. You're saying they can wait in line after the business owner that happens to pay the state general levy. Is that accurate?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. I think one of the things that we're overlooking is that this will only occur if there is a large surplus. Where there is a 5% there that before we reach that 105%, that is there for the legislator to do as the legislature wants to do. Let's just bring some numbers into perspective. Using the 2022 forecast, this is going back to November. There was a non-dedicated general fund reserve of 59.4. The general fund expenditures were 51.7. This amount resulted in a surplus. Two of those numbers, as a result of that 5%, 5.1 would have been going back to taxpayers, but there would have been a $2.6 billion going back to the legislature that would have used for whatever purposes, whether it was for schools, whether it was to go back if the legislature decided at that point that you wanted to send it back to those who paid sales tax and you're able to figure that out, that money was there for that. The over 105% is what is designated to go back to it to go into an account that can then be sent back via income tax refunds, credits, one-time deductions, same with property taxes. So this does not create a zero-sum game that it's all going back. If there is a large surplus, which we currently do not have coming into this year, it's not forecasted for the next time either, but if it does happen in the future, that there will still be 5% there for the legislature to use for the purposes that you want to use, whether that is to continue to go back to schools or the refund sales taxes, send more back to the taxpayers and stuff like that. So the money is there, would be there in a surplus situation to use for those situations.
A follow-up, Representative Yuwaki.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson, for your patience. Last follow-up, and maybe it's more of a comment. So paying our schools and making sure we have the 90-10 split is not considered an projected expenditure. And if we do end up going into a downturn like we did in 2005, 2011, 2012, and we borrow on the backs of our kids, you are saying they're second or third in line to be paid back, because you want to give money back to those business owners and folks that have paid only property and income tax. That's where I have a concern, because other states, when this has happened over time, it's just a spiral down. And we will not be able to fill our budget reserve account anymore, because it will always go back first, so that when we do have a big rainy day, or let's say the bird flu, or we have a horrendous year of tornadoes, we won't be able to tap into anything, because it won't be left. And that is a big concern with this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson, for bringing this bill. I just want to go back to the discussion we had about the sales tax. And, you know, it's kind of shocking that everyone is so worried that the sales tax is left out of this, when my friends on the other side are the ones who raised the metro sales tax by 1% in the last budget. And also all the regressive taxes that were raised for the delivery fee, the license tab fee, the many regressive taxes that were raised last session. So I don't know where that concern for raising the sales tax was last year, but that's what happened on your watch, is the sales tax was raised. And so I encourage the body to support this. Anything that helps return money to taxpayers, which will help us grow the economy, is when we're, and this is, you know, clearly when we're already in a surplus, this is the excess above 105% surplus. I think it makes sense. And I'd like to request a roll call.
Thank you. A roll call has been requested. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And my concerns are maybe a little different. And thank you, Representative Johnson, for bringing the bill. These past 2 years, I worked on a legislative task force on aging. And one of the things that I heard over and over and over is the lack of services, the lack of care, the lack of hospitals, the lack of nursing homes, the lack of educational opportunities for older Minnesotans, the lack of exercise facilities for older Minnesotans, the lack of accessibility for buildings that are in greater Minnesota. And all of these things cost money, right? In order to keep older Minnesotans in their homes, they need a lot of help and a lot of assistance, either in keeping the facilities up to date or getting care into their homes. And this is like one of the largest growing costs in our budget. And so my concern, you don't define who is the taxpayer, right? So when people read a bill, they tend to read it through their own definition of taxpayer. So individuals tend to think about taxpayers as people, not as corporations. So I think the wording of the amendment itself is a little confusing to the ordinary Minnesotan. They won't be thinking about 3M or Medtronic or big corporate campuses getting their property taxes back. What our greater Minnesotan,
Minnesota older adults are telling us is they need a lot of help. And if we go forward with this bill, those are the very people who are actually going to be harmed because there won't be resources to help them. And so I'm a little concerned about that. And then I think even in my suburban community that I represent, I don't think that the property taxpayers of Medicine Lake or even Plymouth, I mean, they want the things that those property taxes pay for, right? So I don't know that they would prefer to have their bit of money back so that, and then not have those amenities and services. So I, you know, I appreciate the fact that you'll be taking this to the voters, but I do think, the trade-off, I don't think people will understand the trade-off, right? There's no free in our state. And we haven't, our schools have, to Chair Joaquin's conversation earlier, our schools have never recovered from the Pawlenty tax cuts, right? The money that didn't go to those school districts at that time. And so, yeah, you know, the Democrats are really interested in investing in the things that help businesses run, like corridors of commerce. We've invested in those roads and infrastructure. We invested in the things that people need most every day, right? So I'm just asking you to think about the unintended consequence of this bill. I think it's really problematic, and I don't think that it would be honest to the voters to not define that businesses would be getting this, large businesses, large corporations. And then my other question to you is it possible that there would be entities in our state that would end up with zero taxes if they get their a return on a surplus like this? I mean, how is that being divided, the return on the taxes?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Would you please define entity for me?
Okay. Representative Claiborne.
Well, an entity is not a human, right? So if you would think about, let's just say a Medtronic or a 3M, would it be possible, and I'm not picking on those two corporations, but would it be possible that they would end up with a zero net tax?
Representative Johnson.
I would like to pass that off to fiscal or nonpartisan to decide that, because I don't have the calculation to figure how much they pay in for a tax. Are they paying in billions of dollars? Then probably not, because the surplus isn't that much. But I would, I don't have the amount of money that the entities are sending in.
To nonpartisan, if you would care to try.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, just conferred with my colleague, and you know, it's theoretically possible that a taxpayer would have a zero net tax liability. Line 1.21 to 1.22 says that the refunds or offsets cannot exceed the liability, but they could equal the liability if the surplus was large enough.
Okay. And one more follow-up. I'll just be very brief.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson. So we've got corporations and we've got pass-through entities, right? LLCs and partnerships, et cetera, right? So some of our largest law firms that pay property tax, you know, or entities like that, is it possible then that they would also pay zero taxes?
Representative Johnson.
I would like to pass that on to nonpartisan, please.
Nonpartisan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Claiborne, I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Well, I'm just saying for LLCs, pass-through entities, and partnerships, is it possible that they would also end up with zero tax liability based on your reading of lines 1.20 and 1.22?
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Claiborne, I think it would depend on the language that the legislature would pass to implement this language to flesh out the details. Because as you've noted, you know, property and income taxpayers, that wouldn't be defined in the Constitution itself. It would need to be defined in the enabling legislation. So it's hard to answer that question now. without the enabling legislation in place.
So, Mr.
Representative Claiborne, briefly.
Yeah, I would just encourage people to vote against this. Our older Minnesotans, especially in greater Minnesota, are in dire need of lots of help, and they need transportation, they need health care, they need long-term care facilities, and I think this would be taking money away from the potential of helping those individuals and serving those who may end up getting a refund that they don't actually need. Thank you.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Johnson, it's a question. Maybe you want to address it in your closing or not, but my question is this. I've heard a lot of things from the other side about what this bill is supposed to be doing, and I keep reading it and rereading it, and I keep rereading it, and I don't see anywhere that they're talking about making budget cuts with this bill, that this is the proposal. What I read it as, and maybe you can confirm this in your closing, that this is a vote to let the people of Minnesota decide if the excess taxes collected by the state should be returned to them. As opposed to, it sounds like they think that if I was to go to McDonald's for lunch today and I was to order a $8 value meal and I gave them $10, that the clerk at McDonald's should decide that they've got a better use of that $2 as opposed to giving it back to me, as they should. And I wouldn't have any say in that. Now, most places now have a, you know, gratuity jar, give it to the vets, give it to the pets, give it to something, you know, throw the excess change in there. And I think what they're trying to say is that the person at the till will decide if any money should be given back as change, or they'll decide who they want to give that generous donation to, or not. So is that the focus of your bill, to put it on a ballot and let the Minnesotans decide, do you get my money back, or do we have to let the person at the till decide where they're going to give your change back? And man, it just makes me want to start paying on credit cards so I don't have to have the excess, because man, what if I only had a 50?
Representative Johnson.
So if you could address that now or wait till your closing, but your bill doesn't talk about anything they say it is, from what I can read. Am I reading the bill right?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You are correct. Thank you for that statement. This is not cutting any funding. This is not cutting funding any schools. It does not. This is only comes into play when we have a large surplus of money, like we've had for a little bit here. So what this does, instead of, and this gives voters a choice, if we support here and vote for it on the floor, goes to the voters, they approve, they get to, you know, essentially decide what is best use of that money, and the money goes back to the voters. Again, there is also a 5% that is there for the legislature to use. And again, that one, 2022, that would have been $2.6 billion to use to cover for the needs that the legislature decides that are needed. And that is the money they get to decide to use. The balance of it, voters will get to decide to use what they can use to help them out for the high cost of living and the effort and the issues that they're experiencing.
Follow-up, Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Johnson, so after I close there, it's like, hey, I mentioned a $50 bill. So if I had a $18 billion bill and I didn't have any smaller change, would you raise the cost of the value meal and not give me back any change? That's not a question.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Katiza Batum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is my first time seeing this bill, so I appreciate that we're able to have a little bit more conversation here today. Since sales taxes have been brought up a number of times, and that the folks who pay the sales taxes here in Minnesota won't be receiving any sort of refund on the taxes that they've contributed, I just was doing a little bit of research because I've been blessed to do some international travel over the course of my lifetime, and one thing that kind of I've had to remember and do a little research on how it works, but in the European Union, they have a value-added tax, which is included in the cost of every good or service that you pay for as a visitor. And then they actually have a system that allows you, if you are not a European Union resident, to ask for a refund on that value-added tax. So I'm just curious if, you know, you said it's really difficult to track that, and this does put the onus back on the taxpayer, right? It is the consumer who is going to have to submit that that receipt that tell us how much sales tax that they had paid. But is this something that you considered while you were putting this amendment together, that another country's system, another governmental unit who's already figured out how to give sales tax paid back to the consumers?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. No, I did not look into what other countries are doing for their tax system. But I also want to remind people, if you want to, with that 5%, which was $2.6 billion in 2022, want to send that back to taxpayers, I would not be opposed to that. You would have that ability. And if you want to do that via sales tax or figure out other ways to do that, you'd still have that 5% to send back.
A follow-up person, Katizo Tune.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to be clear here that the people of Minnesota are not getting this tax refund. It's corporations who pay property taxes. It is wealthy people who pay a lot of income tax. It's not low-income families. It's not seniors who are living on a fixed Social Security income that we've already exempted from state income taxes. Your amendment needs to be more clear on who is receiving the benefit of this. And I think, you know, to the last representative's comments about McDonald's giving us change back, not only is the person at the till at McDonald's not an elected official who was elected to represent and take care of the state budget for their people, for their constituency. Minnesotans, seniors, and our kids in our education system are worth more than loose change, the people of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of going over your amendment, Representative Johnson, if you can clarify for folks, I think your original bill had a choice between the November forecast or the February forecast, but this amendment only has November forecast, which even in my short time here is not really the forecast that we use to determine what our budget is going to look like. So I'm wondering why you selected the November forecast as the opposed to the February forecast.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. We decided on the November forecast because we wanted to be able to give a little bit of a time there for the November. It was just decided there was a little confusion whether we should go November, whether we should go February, and we just decided to go with November.
I don't really hear a reason in there. I'm not understanding what time frame you're looking for, but I would think that this bill would make a little bit more logical sense if it was using the February forecast at the very least, since that's what we actually use to make our budget. My next question, though, is the language that you updated in your amendment as to what would go on the ballot for the constitutional question is very vague. It doesn't tell voters how much of the surplus would be coming back to them. It doesn't tell voters who income and property taxpayers are. In fact, it's like so much vaguer than the original language you had. So I'm really confused as to why you made those choices and what the goal was in changing the language to the point where it's hard to understand what the constitutional amendment would do.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The choice to modify was just to make it for simplicity. So actually it was easier to understand for voters. And put on the ballot.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Agbaje, follow up.
I will just echo my colleagues. I just share a lot of their concerns that, you know, what you're trying to do with this bill just over time is not going to be helpful to the state of Minnesota. It's going to really hamstring the legislature in how we support Minnesotans and how we help address emergencies or crises that the state may have, whether coming from the federal government or coming from natural disasters or something like that. Also, I'm surprised also that the language choices you've decided to take actually kind of hide the ball a little bit from Minnesotans, which I think is a little bit unfair if you're trying to make a constitutional change, because the Constitution is what decides the people who live in Minnesota what rules and regulations that they will be under. And if they're not going to be able to understand that, and they're not going to be able to understand, you know, should this, if this were ever actually to go into effect and how it would work, I think people would be sorely surprised at the effects it would actually have. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Governor Plenty's name was brought up several times today, and I, for one, long for those days when we didn't have massive fraud in our state. But it was said during his tenure that schools still haven't recovered from what happened under the Plenty administration. And if that's true, they still haven't recovered. It seems like the Democrats don't want them to recover. They had $18 billion in sole control of state government and didn't help them recover from what happened over a decade ago. What is really hampering our schools is the 60-plus mandates that was passed.
Mr. Chair, is this relating to the constitutional amendment that is before us today?
To the constitutional amendment. Thank you,
Representative West, please apply your remarks to the bill and to the financial aspects of this constitutional amendment.
Yeah, so given that we have schools passing levies that increase costs on taxpayers because they need the funding, and what makes this bill very much needed is sending the money back to the people, especially through property taxes, to allow them to pay for those levies for those schools from the schools that haven't recovered, apparently, from what happened over a decade ago, despite having $18 billion. So this bill is really important considering the levy situation our schools are enduring, and I thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Moeller, and then we'll go to Representative Stevenson for a closing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a question and then a comment. Do private equity firms, would they qualify then? Private equity firms that perhaps buy up properties in Minnesota, would they qualify for this refund?
Representative Johnson.
Chair, thank you for the question. So if I understand the question correctly, you're asking if somebody buys a home and pays property tax on the home, are they eligible for the property tax refund?
Would you care to clarify your question, Representative Mueller?
Well, thank you. I mean, there are companies that are buying up properties, and I'm just curious if they would be subject to this refund.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are these, I'm assuming this bill will pay property taxes back. If that is chosen, there'll be two options that will be selected for the legislature, whether it's income taxes or property taxes. If somebody pays property taxes on a property to the state, then yes, they would be eligible for a refund if the legislature decided to go that direction.
Quickly, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the answer is yes. So those companies that would buy up properties and pay property taxes would be eligible for this. And I would just note that many of the corporations or the wealthiest people that would benefit from this are the same people who are going to benefit from the tax breaks that are given to the wealthiest people by the Trump administration. I'll also just note to the question about how money at the till is being used, if this were to go into effect in the Public Safety Committee, we maybe wouldn't have been able to do things like this, the funding for victim services program, that we were able to help those programs that provide services to domestic violence and sexual assault victims who are also at risk right now under the Trump administration, money that was put into the disaster contingency account that helped Minnesota when we had floods, really damaging floods in Minnesota, and other natural disasters that helped throughout this state, or the $300 million in public safety aid that came through the tax committee that was really funding things like mental health services for law enforcement. I know St. Paul used it for auto thefts. We had a lot of equipment that was purchased as a result of this, and I've heard from my communities how helpful that money was. That maybe wouldn't have been available if this amendment goes into place. So I am adamantly opposed for those reasons. Thank you.
Representative Stevenson for the wrap-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I have a number of questions. I saw this bill when it was in tax committee, but we have a DE amendment today, and the questions I have only relate to changes that have been made in the DE amendment. We had some discussion. Representative Agbaje asked about the change to specify the November forecast, and you write, I was going to ask why, but we've already asked that question, so I'm going to ask that again. But you specify the November forecast in here in language that would go into the Constitution on the basis of a November forecast. The November forecast, of course, is not created by the Constitution. It's created in statute. So my question is, what happens if the legislature moves the forecast to October or September?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I don't have an answer. I guess when was the last time the legislature has done that?
Well, it's hard to answer a hypothetical question, Representative Johnson. Representative Stevenson.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll ask one that isn't a hypothetical question, although I think it's worth noting, I mean, the forecast system is a relatively new thing in the history of our 150-year history of the state. It's changed. It could change again pretty easily. On line 1.11, this is new language, you say, if there will be a positive unrestricted general fund balance at the close of the biennium. Which biennium are you referring to?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, it would be the biennium, it would be the odd year biennium where the with the budget year.
Representative Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I'm not clear on that. On the basis of that answer, the November forecast makes a projection about three different biennia. So, for example, this November forecast made a projection for the biennia that ended on June 30, 2025, on June 30, 2027, and on June 30, 2029. Which of those three dates would be triggered by this language in the bill?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you for the question. I would ask nonpartisan staff if they have a comment on that.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, I agree that it's not entirely clear from the language that would go into the Constitution. When the biennium is used in 16A.152 to handle the priority uses of a state surplus, it refers to the current budget biennium, the biennium for which the legislature has already enacted a budget.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, Mr. Sullivan. That was my reading of it, too, that it would probably refer to the current budget biennium and not the biennium that which we are budgeting for. So if the purpose of this bill was to make sure that $18 billion got returned, you didn't accomplish it with this because you're talking about the biennium that we're in, not the one that's being projected. My last question about the language, and then I do have some comments. On line one, and this gets a little bit to what Representative Mueller was just talking about, line 1.14, you say set aside in a budget reserve account. And I assume you're making reference to the budget reserve, you know, $3.5 billion currently funded. You made a reference to that. But my question is, does this language apply to the emergency the fund that funds emergency operations? There's a transfer from the November, if there's a projected surplus in the November forecast, there's an automatic transfer into the emergency fund. And I'm wondering, does this language refer to that fund or just the budget reserve? And if so, why does it say A? and not the.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the representative. I'd like to pass this on to nonpartisan if they have an opinion on this.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, it's not clear. I think it's implied that a budget reserve is the budget reserve provided for by law. So I'd say it's not clear if the transfer to the disaster assistance contingency account is included in this calculation or not.
Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your patience letting me ask a number of questions there. I'll stop with questions. I think I have a few more sketched out on here. I think it's really clear to me that this language is not ready to become law, let alone go into the Constitution of the state of Minnesota. We've talked a little bit in the last committee about where we talked about this bill, about my concerns about what happens when there's an exigent circumstance, some emergency that happens after the forecast that was not foreseen in the forecast, like, you know, the COVID pandemic was an example of that I lived through in my time in the legislature, which had a dramatic impact on the budget. But there's other examples. And, you know, I have to say, there is almost comically bad timing in bringing this proposal forward right now. And I almost feel bad for you, Representative Johnson, because the President of the United States seems bound and determined to prove to you that this is a bad idea every single day that's gone on. It just seems like every day he wakes up and says, how can I show the state of Minnesota that they shouldn't handcuff themselves in their budget? You know, whether it's last week when we saw tariffs going on and off and then on again and then off again, it's like every day you wake up, are we going to have tariffs on Canada or not? I mean, that has a big impact on Minnesota's state budget. And in November, you picked the November forecast, we had no idea that any of that was going to happen. You know, a couple weeks ago, the U.S. House passed a budget resolution that called for $880 billion in cuts to the Medicaid program. There's been a presentation to the Senate Finance Committee that showed that could result in a $3 to $6 billion impact to Minnesota's budget. That was not foreseeable in the November forecast. Worth noting that that's, by the way, to fund $4.5 trillion in tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. I just checked, you know, I generally have this idea about the market that I don't look at it because especially right now, because it makes me stressed out about my retirement. But, the S&P is down 7% in less than a month. That has a big impact on Minnesota's budget and was entirely not foreseeable in the November forecast. If you went back and looked at the November forecast, I guarantee you it has a projection for the S&P 500. It did not project it would be going down 7% in less than a month. So, you know, we're zigging and zagging, we're going all over the place at the federal level, has a big impact on Minnesota's budget. You say this bill is fiscally conservative, I say it's fiscally reckless. But that's okay, because it's not gonna be law. It's not gonna be in the Constitution. I think even you know it's not gonna be in the Constitution because this bill hasn't even been introduced in the Senate yet. I'm not sure why we're hearing it in Ways and Means with a DE, the second DE on this bill, when it hasn't even been introduced in the other body, let alone gotten a hearing, nor is it going to pass the House floor. There aren't 68 votes for this bill. So this has been an interesting theoretical discussion. I heard the chair say it's hard to respond to a hypothetical. This is a hypothetical bill. It's not going to be reality. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Any closing remarks, Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Chair, members of the board, for allowing me to present this again. Again, this is a bill that is only for if there is a large surplus. I know I've heard a lot of concerns of what if, but we have to also remember, in order for this to go into play, there has to be a large surplus. That means there will be billions and billions and billions of dollars for the legislature to use for circumstances that they wish to do. This is also to ensure going forward there will not be or do the best effort at 40% increase in the budget from one budget year to another. This also addresses the need that, and I keep hearing that we don't want to take care of those who need the money out of fear that it may benefit somebody that doesn't need the money. We have to remember, this is what we heard, and I heard, and many Republicans heard at the door. We have seniors that have their house paid off. Maybe they're not paying taxes on their Social Security, but their property taxes keep increasing, increasing, and increasing. And a lot of that has to do with decisions made at this level. This will provide them a lifeline and a resource of funds to help them out so they can continue to pay for their food and stay in their homes. I hope you I get a positive vote on this. Thank you, members.
Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I renew the motion that House File 4, as amended, be placed on the General Register. The Committee of Legislative Assistant will take the roll.
Chair Torkelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Akam.
No.
Representative Agbaje.
No.
Representative Baker.
Aye.
Representative Bierman.
No.
Representative Gomez.
No.
Representative Heintzman.
Aye.
Representative Igo.
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn.
No.
Representative Cagle. Representative Cassis-Watoon.
No.
Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Representative Kreisha.
Aye.
Representative Lilly. Representative Moeller.
No.
Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative Neuer.
No.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Pinto.
No.
Representative Rarick.
Aye.
Representative Schumacher.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Swedzinski.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
No.
Representative West.
Aye.
Representative Joachim.
No.
Representative Cagle. Representative Lilly.
There being 14 ayes and 11 nays, the bill passes. General Register, congratulations, Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Members, next on the agenda is a presentation from the Association of Minnesota Counties. If they would come forward at this time. Take your time. We don't want anyone to be injured.
Mr. Chair, are the coffees, where are the cookies at again? Could you remind us of where those were? I forgot.
There are cookies, Representative Swedzinski, in the back corner. I think we'll get a volunteer to distribute them. Good morning. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Matt Hilgart. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties, and I'm joined here by my colleague.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Nathan Jessen. I represent the Minnesota Inter-County Association. The Minnesota Inter-County Association represents 17 of the largest counties in Minnesota after Hennepin and Ramsey.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the invite to be here today. We're hopeful this presentation has some bipartisan love and support, being county governments from across your state, your partners in administering state law. When it's convenient in an arm of the state, and when it's convenient on another perspective, a local government. But thank you for your invitation, Mr. Chair, and I think from how you invited us, we're going to be speaking a little bit about county budgeting in general, some of the impacts of some budget proposals at a state level, and then I know that you have a shared passion alongside others about this issue of IT modernization for some of the systems that we use on a day-to-day basis, and we'll actually be bringing forward two specialists here to give a little testimony on that. So as a precursor, we'll go over kind of a rough roll of what counties do, who we are, how counties are funded, the role and history of some of the state aids that we receive, governor's budget and impact on county governance and property taxes, the systems modernization and IT woes discussion, and then we'll get back to policy considerations for this 2025 session. When we get to the story of kind of what counties do, we understand that as local units of government, we are often the kind of misunderstood layer of local government most of the time. Some of our work is pretty invisible, right? You're not interacting necessarily on a day-to-day, at least noticeably on a day-to-day basis with your county governments. But we do provide a social safety net for Minnesotans. We're one of a small portion of states nationwide that rely on our counties to administer those social safety net services. In general, we administer the property tax system through your county assessors. We run elections alongside our city partners. Minnesota is one of the lowest per capita rates of incarcerated populations. We do a lot of that work in community, and community means us. We are your county and local probation agents, correction officers, et cetera. We invest and manage the most miles of any infrastructure in terms of roads, transportation, highway, et cetera. We are your workforce and economic development boards, your public health authorities, although we do have four city public health authorities. Most of them are counties. We manage, as was brought to light last year during the legislative session, the tax forfeiture process on behalf of the state statutorily. And that's a big one, too, that we appreciated a little bit of the attention last session. We provide an array of social services, housing, food support, rental, mental health support, child and family well-being services. Another lesser known but very active role for counties is managing our solid waste and recycling. In fact, some of these infrastructures are some of the most costly that we maintain at a countywide level. They also sometimes are some of the most innovative technologies that we are investing in, whether it be anaerobic digesters that we're hoping to fund or other sorting and automatic recycling features. Libraries, everyone loves the libraries. We are investing in managing our regional library centers along with the mandates related to law libraries. We still have elected officers, being the county sheriff's, county attorney's office. And then we also have these fallback duties. And I like to think that the legislature has a lot of confidence in counties. I think one of the examples, COVID was brought up by Representative Stevenson earlier. I remember when in December of 2020. I remember in 2020 when we got called by bipartisan legislators saying, hey, we want to stand up a state COVID business relief program. We said, great. Who do you think is going to run it? They're like, you, the counties. And we're going to give you 30 days to do it. Now, luckily, we got that extended out to 60 days, but we, as 87 counties, got up and operational with $116 million of the funds you gave us, a COVID business relief program in each of your districts in 60 days. That's what we do. We respond. And another thing that I also like to think about is when we just know as a state we should do something, oftentimes if there's no one volunteering, sometimes you give us that responsibility too. One of those tasks, and I said this in front of the House Tax Committee, is indigent funeral. So in Minnesota, we believe that if you cannot afford to do a respectful and proper burial for yourself, the state should take care of that for you. Well, in reality, that's the county. And there's no funds assigned to that. But these costs are pretty significant. In Hennepin County, it can be close to $1 million a year. In St. Louis County, it's $450,000 last year. These are percentage basis on a percentage point of a levy, and we do that on behalf of the state.
Thank you. Mr. Hilgard talked a lot about all the wide array of services the counties provide, whether they're at the local level or mandated by the state. I just wanted to provide some data here on, you know, how counties are funded. And as you can see, when we're talking about the county paying for things, just overwhelmingly property taxes, right? That's 85%. And this is, you know, a strong contrast to the state, of course, which you all know and understand has a much wider array of tools when it comes to revenue. You know, we're predominantly income and sales. I think Representative Gomez earlier mentioned about a quarter of the state revenue comes from the sales tax. And all other taxes here for counties, if we're talking about that 13%, those are overwhelmingly specifically dedicated to certain projects. So there's not the kind of flexibility. If we're talking about county general fund revenue, we're really talking about overwhelmingly the property tax. So if we were providing a picture of general fund, the property tax percentage here would be much greater than it is even right here. Did want to provide a little bit more data on how other states fund local government. This is data from other states. It's not county specific from these other states, I want to be clear. And just kind of provide a picture of what some of these other states do. To be clear, we're not saying one of these is better than the other or better than Minnesota, but it does just kind of provide a picture of how much more reliant Minnesota is on property taxes compared to other states, generally speaking. Sales and income taxes, even. There's about a dozen states with local income taxes, but especially sales taxes are more prominent tools in other states for funding local government. To be clear, also, these pie charts don't factor in revenue from the state, state aids. I do think that, you know, a common response is often, well, Minnesota doesn't have as many tools for local governments to raise revenue. They provide a higher level of state aid to local governments. That's generally true, but I would say that counties receive less aid than cities by a few hundred million dollars per year. And Minnesota is also not like a top five state if you're looking at the percentage of state aid compared to the revenue raised at the local level. Did want to kind of briefly go over just some history of county property tax levies. I've also got all other local government levies up here, just so you have that information. That's your cities, your school districts, your special taxing districts, your townships. Just kind of want to make 3 points. Generally, county levies tend to increase more when inflation is high or when state aids are reduced or when mandates from the state increases. That's all pretty intuitive, right? And I would say that levy increases, the times when they're especially low, are during recessions or difficult, you know, economic times. And as you can see, I think 2010 to 2012 is a really good example of that. And also, and Mr. Hilgart brought up the county response to the COVID-19 pandemic earlier. Levies increased by a much lower amount than typical at that moment in time when taxpayers were facing a lot of uncertainty, both at the individual and business level.
We appreciate your latitude in letting us talk a little bit about just the aids that you provide us as a state. This next slide talks about CPA, or commonly known as county program aid, and that is our main state general purpose aid. It's similar to LGA or local government aid, which is what cities receive. We're about, as Mr. Jessen said, about half that amount. And this chart in specific, the one on the left, really just shows a depreciation of just the purchasing power of CPA over the course of two decades. Now, there are some notable increases on the far right of each, the graph on the left and the right, and we thank the legislature in 2023 for putting a historic amount of resources back here. But regardless, it does show that slow depreciation and trend line downwards over the years. You can see that at one point, CPA could be on average 10 or 12% of a county's budget. And now we're a little bit on average, I think right around 8 or 6, but for a lot of counties, it's right around 5 or 4%. And the other thing is just, even if we were to include inflation in here, which the budget does now for the state, you can see that that really gets out of whack and out of line with where we would be. I put this slide on here just for some context and frankly for some kudos for the legislature, because this does show some volatility around CPA. As with every state aid category, we go through periods of review and deciding whether or not we need to fix the formulas. This shows two facets: one, the depreciating power, and two, just an extreme roller coaster of volatility that we tried to address in recent years. This is Representative Swazinski's district, Lacaille-Parle County, but you can see in 2005 that Lacaille-Parle County received a little over $800,000 in CPA. And when we're talking about this, remember, in Pipestone County, Representative Schumacher's district, the entire county, spreading the wealthier, the entire county receives $1.2 million. The city of Pipestone receives over $2.2 million. So there is that disparity here, and that's an important thing to just keep in mind here, too. On this chart in particular, it shows that at one point, Lacaille-Parle County's CPA had gone from $800,000 down to less than $100,000. That is a significant, significant impact. In the 2016 and 17 legislature, we tried to readdress and kind of fix the formula and provide some stability. And when we talk about stability in the formula, the last time you injected funds into the CPA formula, everyone got within 1% of the same increase. So I think it was roughly 30% increases for each county. They were within 30 to 31% each and every county. So that volatility has been reduced significantly because of your action here at the legislature in the last few sessions.
I did want to cover some of the proposed cost shifts that are included in the governor's budget recommendations. This isn't Representative Schumacher's committee. He did hold a hearing on this earlier this session, which I thought was really informative and covered these issues in more detail. But I did want to touch base on it here because the fiscal implications are really significant. All in all, these cost shifts, which are prominently in the human services area, total over $200 million a biennium. And, you know, earlier I talked about the county revenues. It's like, well, when you're talking about cost shifts to county governments, you're talking about the property tax, right? And that would be the case here as well. I do want to note, and Mr. Hilgard talked about county program aid. County program aid was increased by $80 million in the last biennium, and that was significant, and it was historic. It was by far the largest increase in county program aid that we've ever seen before. But it also is like much smaller than the kind of cost shifts that we're talking about just from this this proposed budget, these budget recommendations. And those increases before were also in response to inflation and other changes from the state. Most of these are in the HHS realm, some are in the tax realm, and Mr. Hilgard's going to kind of go over some more specific local impacts and what they mean.
And again, the only way to finance these shifts, we would argue, would be through the property tax system. And so I put four counties up here as examples, and this is from survey data that we compiled in mid-February. The counties are Dakota, Anoka, Beltrami, and Ramsey. And as you can see here, Dakota broke down their $11.5 million in total potential shifts, showing that a great majority of this comes from that disability waiver services cost shift of 5%. I think what's interesting for Dakota County, and I appreciate their analysis, is that total amount equals more than their total library services, their park services, their local public health and public disease control, and their snow and ice management budgets for the Public Works Department all put together. It would equal a 7% levy increase right out of the gate without talks of COLAs, without any of the other things that we may talk about today. Anoka County, a kind of similar split. Their MSOP shift in this case is pretty sizable. You can see, again, that's just increasing the bill to county. I believe that's moving the bill to 45% where it was, I'm looking at folks in the audience, around 20% prior. It's just making counties pay a higher bill. And as we talk, if we go back to CPA, I think that's how we'd like to legislators to think about it. Certainly, we all believe that CPA is direct property tax relief, direct or indirect, however you want to see it. But think about this, too. If you're not willing to entertain that consideration, think about it as a half-paid IOU. Because some of these things that we're talking about, it seems as though the state's going into potentially a restaurant of services saying, we're going to ask you to do all these on behalf of the state, and then here, we'll pay you half the bill that it really costs. Beltrami County, and Chair Gomez knows that I'm particularly sympathetic to Beltrami County because of their property tax constraints, but this one would be a 9% increase in their levy. And why I say I'm concerned, especially for counties who have tax-based limitations, is there is not equity in tax rates across the state of Minnesota. Beltrami County has one of the highest tax rates. It is always in the top one or two of property tax rates in the state of Minnesota. This is because of two issues. Three issues. It's a large county, sometimes larger than certain states altogether. It has a significant part of its property that is tax exempt and does not receive any PILT, federal PILT or state PILT for it. So just completely tax exempt. And the third thing is, on a per capita basis, it does have higher service needs than any other county. And so is it fair for that county to be paying a disproportionate amount for mandated services when their community themselves are not in a position to pay, especially if you take a look at average median income or even poverty levels? Unfortunately for Beltrami County, they don't do well in either of those statistics. So a 9% levy in this increase, I would argue no county could absorb a 9% levy, but in particular, Beltrami is not in a good space. And then Ramsey County, I'm grateful for them breaking down their potential impact here as well. And then we'd really like to get, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, to our special guests here, because we have really appreciated bipartisan interest in just a lot of these factors. One second, I'm just going to try to see if... we have really appreciated bipartisan attention on some of these factors. I think we would put, when we talk about things that limit our success or our efficiencies as governmental units, we'd kind of put them into three tranches. The unfunded mandate piece, which every legislature is aware of, probably ad nauseum, we come and talk about them quite frequently. The policies or things that might not be spending related, but really impact our flexibility and approach to do things efficiently and meet our needs immediately. And then this third component, which I'm so excited to welcome our guests here today to talk about, which is the obsolete but mandated archaic technology systems that we use. And we know that people of both political parties are aware. If you haven't been invited by your county to spend a day in the life of a child protection services worker, we would really encourage you to. It's quite moving. And without further ado, I'd just invite a couple of our presenters and special guests to just give a little bit of a presentation on this issue.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourselves for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Morning, Chair and representatives. It's great to be here. Grateful for the opportunity to kind of give you some information on these archaic systems today. So there's a lot of systems that need updating.
Excuse me. Right? Please identify yourself for the record.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. My name is Nadir Abdi. I am the Director of Employment and Economic Assistance for Dakota County. Grateful to be here today, and I'm going to be talking a little bit about the modernization issues that the state is having currently and going through some of these slides. You'll see that there's a lot of need here at the state, but I'm not gonna focus on all of these. You'll see that each of these systems is archaic and it's outdated and needs some sort of revolutionized. And in the MACCESS system, you can see the date is 1989. Men Choices, 2013. MEC Square, 2007. MMIS, 1994, PRISM, 1997, and SSIS, 1994. So in the interest of time today, we're going to be focusing on two systems, the MACCESS system and the SSIS system. I'll start with the MACCESS system, and then my colleague from Scott County will talk a little bit about the SSIS system. So I decided to play a video. And I'll try to talk over the video. It's about 1.5 speed, and it's panels. So first I'll just give you an overview of the MACCESS system. It's a legacy system software that is used in several government agencies for managing public assistance programs and has been in operation for several decades. While it served its purpose for years, it is incredibly becoming difficult to maintain and scale in today's fast-paced technology landscape. So when
is it going?
Yeah. It is, yeah. Okay. So if you can look at these panels that is showing on the screen, when an individual comes to us and looks for assistance, we have to key in the information, and it's by keystrokes. These are like F1, F2, F3. It's almost like a language of its own, right? That people have to really understand how to manage. Each keystroke has a meaning. Each keystroke has a definition of what needs to be done in the case. Each panel, like for instance, if there's a school panel, there's a review panel, there's a job and income panel, there's a shelter expense panel, and then there's a case note panel. So as you are entering the information of a family, so for example, if I'm a family, if I am a two household parent, if I have a child, if my child is going to school, all of those panels are going to be entered. So we're talking about almost 40 panels that a financial worker has to submit information into a system. So this possibly takes a few hours to complete, just one individual case. And when you have thousands of cases, you can understand the magnitude of these issues that these systems create and how they're bogged down. And the training that also takes. For someone to fully understand these functions of the system, it does take a full 12 to 18 months. So when you're thinking about retention purposes, right, the day of someone coming into a job and retiring is no longer here. You have people coming into a job for 3 to 5 years. And when you are training someone from 12 to 18 months, and then within a year of that, they're looking for their next thing, that is not a good return on investment. It feels like a disservice to the taxpayers and the constituents that are really utilizing these tools. I'll come back to the closing of the workforce issues and shortages, but for now I want us to kind of talk a little bit about the next system, which is very similar to the issues that I just relayed in this system, in the SIS system.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is nice to be here today and have the opportunity to speak with you about SSIS. My name is Samantha Goldman. I am a child protection supervisor within Scott County. I want to make 2 points today during my presentation to you about SSIS, and I want to focus on the daily experience of workers, and then I want to also focus on the impact to families. So starting out with the daily experience, as you can see SSIS up there, there is what we like to call the wheel of death. Unfortunately, you don't get to see it, but it is a blue circular wheel that spins probably regularly if you click on a screen. So workers have to do data entry within this system. They will click on a node or a folder. You will get the spinning wheel of death for about probably 10 to 20 seconds. The system will then respond to your clicks. And so now imagine doing this for an out-of-home placement plan of 10 to 15 pages. Data entry that workers input that don't understand why they're doing the data entry because it doesn't necessarily tie directly to the families they're working with. And then they're dealing with a system where they're inputting data into multiple places redundantly. So one screen will ask for the same information in a different way 5 screens later. Another example of this would be the newly implemented two-page summary out-of-home placement plan. I love the theory. I think it's a great concept and needs to be implemented for families to understand what is being expected of them. But as it currently stands, it's a redundant data entry that goes from the out-of-home placement plan and is copied into a two-page summary. So adding another redundant data entry for families that, or for workers that probably don't need to be there. A lot of times SSIS is also down without notice. So when a worker goes in and plans their day to do an out-of-home placement plan, do case notes, or their required SSIS time entry, SSIS won't respond. It may be down for an hour. It may be down for 2 hours. Nobody knows. And so then you have to replan your day. That then impacts your work with families because you do not have the ability to necessarily bring out your case plan and provide that to the family because you had intended to complete that within the system, print it out, and bring it, but you were unable to do that. The last point I wanted to make regarding the daily experience for workers is the workflow stoppage and the lack of intuitiveness of this system. So you have workers similar to the financial unit where it takes an average of 18 months to actually feel comfortable being a child protection worker and knowing what you're doing. When you go into a system and you're trying to click on something and you're 7 pages into completing an adoption benefit agreement or a relative benefit agreement and you click on that screen and it's grayed out because you don't know why, there's no system telling you here's what you need to do next. It then requires you to go back 5 to 7 steps to repeat everything to figure out what you did wrong. A lot of times that then requires you to reach out to your SSIS mentor at the county to say, what data error am I missing? Which then oftentimes results in conversations with DHS around what data error are we missing so that I can complete this screen. The next part I want to transition into impact to clients. So I had spoken earlier about when a worker is trying to complete an out-of-home placement plan and they are unable to because the system does not allow it, that impacts the client's ability to get that case plan in a timely manner. That impacts the time away from families working with them on addressing the safety and well-being concerns within their family unit. The language of SSIS is also not written in a way that families can understand. Some of the language within the case plans, within the entry areas within SSIS are written in a very professional way that oftentimes workers, new workers, and even veteran workers have a hard time understanding. So when you print this out and bring this to the family, they don't understand what you're asking or what that bullet point is speaking to. And then the last thing I will say about impact to clients is that SSIS is critical in how we respond to a new report. For example, we had a report where the allegation was prenatal exposure to THC. SSIS was down the day that worker received that report, And we're unable to do any history search and gather information about what they were walking into. They made a plan with the family around the THC use of this newborn. They come back to the office the next day. SSIS is finally up. They review the history and realize that this family has had 6 prior involuntary termination of parental rights, and that it actually warranted an investigation based on their history and the concerns that had SSIS been available and working, we would have been able to address with the family at the onset. That impacts worker-client relationships because it doesn't allow the worker to go out and have a fully transparent conversation about what the actual worries are because they weren't aware of it. And that is all. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee, so as you heard from my colleague and I, it does seem like these two systems have served their purpose, and we need to figure out the next steps. I just want to mention that when people step into these roles, they don't step into these roles to become administrators. They step into these roles because they truly care about taking care of people and being there for people. And it feels like once they are in the role, 60 to 70% of their time is spent on administrating these systems and less time in actually being with the people that they have decided to serve. So it's a big problem and it's programmatic. And when I think about the workforce shortage, I think about in the next decade, we will have a really severe issue in this workforce, because the baby boomers that have started in this sector have retired. The next phase of people are in the cusp of retiring. You're not going to find Gen Zs looking at a system from the 1980s. I kid you not, the MAXA system that I've talked about, I was in middle school, I think, and that's 1989. And I did not think that we would be here today to look at that system. But when you have Gen Zs come into a training facility and look at a green screen, I don't think they have a lot of patience or appetite to stay within that environment. So I am very, very worried at the workforce that we're going to create for the future. So we need to really understand that the systems that we have in front of us are going to cripple us in the future if we don't do something about it. So I appreciate your time. I understand how difficult it is in the budget season to look at different things, and there's a lot of things in your plate, but system modernization, I felt, is a very dire need and in the state of Minnesota, and we need to figure out how to do something about it.
I want to briefly provide, on May 8th, 2024, SSIS was down for 5 hours. The cost per hour was equal to $5,815, which equaled about $29,077 for that day. The total service impact statewide for that 5 hours of it being down equaled $360,530.
Thank you. Representative Nash has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a technologist, this is frightening. I'm sure Representative Neuer would agree that this is just in desperate need of an update. Running an AS400 that's probably got an antiquated programming language behind the scenes just says, please update us. And I think you would see a number of benefits from that, both from a process, procedure, efficiency perspective, but also from a cybersecurity perspective, because the underlying language of this application is something that is pretty much open to and susceptible to cyber attacks. Also holds a lot of proprietary information, a lot of private information. So we need to do a little bit better on this. I appreciate the presentation. This is something that I've realized and known for a very long time. I would also point out to membership that if there were to be a major problem with the underlying code, you would have to bring somebody out of retirement to come and fix the code. So yep. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Briefly, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. I wasn't sure if the testifier was going to speak, but I just want to note as the person, as the chair of the committee with jurisdiction over SSIS, and I said this to you privately, Chair, as well, funding every dime of IT requests in 2023 was a very high priority, and we definitely did do that. I may just say to counties, please make sure to come to us with your needs, because I will say this was not something that was brought up in 23. It did come up in 24, and so we invested some funds in 24. But certainly would have invested more in 23, but we're not aware, and believe me, you asked a lot of questions. So I just would encourage counties, keep on coming with your needs, because this is absolutely a high priority. Thank you, Chair.
Back to the presentation. Mr. Hilgard.
Representative Nash, Representative Knorr, Representative Pinto, thank you for your shared bipartisan passion on this. I think we are asking just for elevation of this concern is what you're hearing us. You wouldn't see me at this table. I'm in the tax committee. I hang out in elections committee and pensions committee. But this is truly something that has united 87 counties, and not even the professionals who are doing their jobs, but the county commissioners who are throwing their hands in the air and saying, what the heck? It's as Mr. Abdi stated, a workforce issue, which this next slide talks about. I mean, Ms. Jessie Van Berkel from the Star Tribune actually did a day in the life at Dakota County, or at Scott County, and one of my favorite quotes is, you know, one morning last year, DHS staff members visited Scott County. They had planned to sit with the county workers and see what it's like to work with the technology. The system was down the entire time. That is what we're getting to. Certainly the legislature did do, I think it was Representative Chair Pinto, $200 million in 2023 for modernization funds for the state. And that's an important investment. We rely on a lot of those technologies too, just as previous presenters testified. We are just hoping a prioritization, wherever it is, if it's bonding eligible, if we can utilize some of those funds from the previous expenditure and set aside funds on modernization, we are saying these two issues, particularly SSIS, need to be prioritized. And that's the message that we're trying to convey.
Mr. Hilgard, I'm going to interrupt you briefly. Representative Knorr has a question or comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you. I think the system needs to be updated. As someone who has used all the systems, it's time. I think it's we have to do something. But the question I have is, what would be the cost of modernization of all these systems that we just talked about?
Mr. Hilgard.
Mr. Chair, I do see someone in the room who might have specific numbers on this. I believe the SSIS system itself is anywhere in the range of a total cost of $80 to $100 million. Now, I would note that half of that is potentially reimbursable by federal dollars. I will also give kudos to the legislature. They did set aside some money in the last budget bill. I believe it was $10 million. There's a budget proposal in the governor's budget to do an additional investment in that. We are saying whatever crumbs you can find wherever, within that modernization fund too, I believe there was a report on the utilization of the total modernization fund of the state dollars. Is there some flexibility in that as well? Wherever you can find it, collect it, and send it to this effort, that's what we're asking for.
Follow up, Representative Knorr.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note that only SSIS is about $100 million. And we haven't talked about MAXIS, which is the engine of all the other programs, because that's where you enter your information. That's where you get your PMI. That's how you connect the dots between all the systems, which I think we're looking about $1 billion cost if we're truly going to invest in this whole system. But at least we got to start somewhere. So. Appreciate you bringing this forward. I think we need to have more conversations on systems modernization. Thank you.
Back to the presentation.
We have one last slide, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your patience.
Mr. Chair, members, just wanted to touch on a couple high-level things before we close out here. We've had a great conversation on systems modernization when it comes to mandates from the state. A couple things we're also just like keeping our eye on. The African American Family Preservation Act, this was passed last year. The legislature allocated one-time money to Ramsey and Hennepin counties, which had those earlier required effective dates. We'd just like to continue conversations about resourcing all counties as we approach the January 1, 2027 effective date for that act. Paid family leave, we've had great conversations with Chair Baker and Representative Frazier about some changes we're looking for in those areas, things like the premium rate split treatment of seasonal employees or elected officials. So we want to just continue those conversations. And then I want to talk a little bit about numbers that are really big that don't necessarily show up on fiscal notes or revenue estimates, which are property tax shifts. We talked a little bit about those before, but it's common for exclusion or shifts for one type of property statewide to come up. They might not show up as a big impact for this committee on a spreadsheet, but that property tax impact, like we were talking about earlier, that property tax shift is real to both homeowners and businesses anytime those are considered. And just lastly, don't forget counties. Almost every committee has some kind of tie-in with counties at one point or another. There's impact across the state, across issue jurisdictions, and we're here to help. We're here to be a resource. You can always talk to me or Mr. Hilgard. If we don't know the answer, we can find someone that does. So just don't hesitate to reach out to us.
Thank you. Representative Mueller has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for the presentation. One thing I didn't see in here is what the counties are monitoring as far as federal impacts and the cuts that we're expecting from the Trump and Musk administration. If you could address that, please.
Mr. Hilgard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, I appreciate that. The association just actually got back from Washington, D.C. just last week, where several county officials from across the state attended numerous sessions trying to figure out, frankly, what is going on in terms of the budget picture. As you know, there's a lot of Medicaid dollars in specific that run through the state of Minnesota. So we didn't come back with a certainty on what the potential consequences might be in any budget decision, but it certainly was something that unified all counties in terms of being elevated concerned about what this could mean for not only the state budget, but in turn county services and funds as well.
Thank you. A brief follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yep, thank you for that. And just a comment, I think, you know, obviously Medicaid is a huge concern. I'm thinking about SNAP benefits and other food benefits. I know of a nonprofit that's already unable to deliver some of the medically necessary food that they provide because of some benefits that have been cut from the ag funding that they receive, housing, you know, cuts to HUD. I mean, all of these things I would think would have a huge impact on counties because if people aren't able to eat and they don't have a place to live, I would think that would really be difficult for the counties to handle as well. So just wanted to make that point.
Representative Cutizzo-Batone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to make a quick ask of the counties. As the co-chair of the Children and Families Committee, I mean, we've heard a lot about SSIS in particular. A number of us actually visited Scott County and did a walkthrough just last week. It was very helpful. But since you brought up the African American and underrepresented children Family Preservation Act, I'm curious. I've heard from two counties specifically about the anticipated costs at 100% implementation, and to the extent that you've been in touch with all of the counties and have a little bit better idea of what the costs may be, it's a really important program. I mean, that implementation is a huge priority for all of us, I think, both in the metro and across the state of Minnesota. But anything that could help us get our heads around potentially what that looks like would also be really beneficial, because I know the SSIS investment will support that, but if there's anything beyond, that would be helpful to know.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hilgard.
Thank you, and I very much appreciate that being brought up. And it certainly is something on behalf of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, AMC, too. I want to be clear that we have not come to the legislature this year asking to repeal the Minnesota African American Family Preservation and Child Welfare Disproportionality Act. If you don't mind, I'll just call it the Act from here on out. This is a tough issue. We represent 87 counties, right? There's a variety of different perspectives on this. We do have some counties, I believe some counties, who have even reached out to members in this room here today, too, who have said, we just can't do this. Please repeal or delay. We have another tranche of counties who say, listen, like, there should be a pathway to do this that involves the resourcing of the technologies, the caseworker support, the additional support for the services required under the act. And then there's another group of counties that say, we should have been doing this. We should have been doing this already. Come on, let's do it. I think what's very hopeful for me is that when we get in rooms as our membership, even with that eclectic divergence of kind of interests as 87 counties, there is this underlying feeling of this is the right thing to do. There is also an equivalency in a fearfulness of the Beltrami counties of what does this mean? The Wadena counties with the second highest tax rate of this is multiple millions. And if you don't mind, I think I'd like to just chat just quickly about the three categories that we're kind of thinking and we're just transparently trying to assess impact on, because the Legislative Budget Office did have an LBO note, but they were tasked with an impossible task. This is an extremely complicated issue. This is projections, right? We have two pilots that are going on right now. We're still learning a lot from those pilots, but we don't have tangible specific dollars. We've done our own assessment, so the LBO didn't have specific dollars. They laid out what the impacts could be. I think generally speaking, I'd put them into four buckets. There's the staffing needs, which we would argue are elevated. They are increased. Changing from reasonable efforts to active efforts just changes caseloads. Right now, depending on which county you're in, a reasonable effort caseload could be one caseworker per 9 to 11 cases. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. Changing to active efforts can reduce that caseload down to 5 or 6, so one per every 5 to 6. You do the math, we're going to have more. Disproportionality itself is defined differently in the act that was passed versus the first act that was proposed in the legislature. So we're actually seeing a heightened amount of impact in rural Minnesota because disproportionality follows poverty lines. We're seeing some counties who are saying 90 to 95% of their cases will now fall in this disproportionality impact. So if you're taking those staffing ratios and applying it to 90 to 95% of your caseload, you can see, and just hypothetically speaking, it's going to be increasing. The resourcing of services is another area that I think garners attention too, because active efforts means that if a family presents itself saying, hey, the reason that we aren't finding stability is because we don't have childcare or we don't have housing, we would interpret that to require the counties to actually provide that. And again, that's not state supported. I think this is a good, again, agreement area of counties. If the barrier to a family being a family preservation and a family staying together is rent for 6 months or childcare, I think there's a lot of counties who would say, we should do that. We know that it's not only the right thing to do, it keeps that family together and it results in probably a better outcome both for society in general and hopefully property taxpayers down the line. So that's something that we like, but let's be honest, Minnesota doesn't fund child support in the state of Minnesota. We are at the bottom, and when I say bottom, bottom six of states that fund child support. Guess who funds the child support in the state? For the most part, it's county property taxpayers. The state's around 26%, the feds are 27%, the rest is us. No other state is like that. In fact, most states average 10% local share. So here we have a state mandated expectation of what we deliver to families, but we're not willing as a state to say, we got your back, we're gonna support that. So what it means is 87 different counties with 87 different tax bases and 87 different tax rates saying we have to fund these. You can imagine the cacophony of results that you get there and the inequity in what taxpayers are paying for those results. The last two impact areas that we're just watching is the legal county attorney resources, the increased court actions. Remember, not only is it county attorney costs, the legislature has also mandated that we pick up court-appointed counsel fees for all CHIPS cases. That cost is increasing. It also could be a conflict of interest. We're both a different side of the aisle in these legal disputes, and we're paying for attorneys on both sides. And then the last thing, which we talked about today, is we would argue that the technology system, and Representative Noor, respectfully, that's why we, I think, are so centered on SSIS, is because we see the implementation of the act, which is 2027. That's why there's urgency behind we got to get SSIS up and operational, because if we're changing those caseloads and we don't even have the system right now that's functional, we have the wheel of death, we have people going home on weekends to enter caseload, this is going to really exasperate that issue. So I appreciate the latitude you gave me, but those are the four general areas that I think as association we're trying to say, let's really spend time this session to tend to this so that we can be successful at this implementation.
A quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your latitude. That was a very comprehensive response that I was not anticipating. And I think I just want to flag, because I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, that we had a unanimous green board to pass the act last session, and I think that it is a high priority for all of us in this room and our colleagues to make sure that we are able to keep families with their children when it is safe
thing to do. So I appreciate that information and how it impacts our partners on the ground at the county level. Thank you.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again for that detailed answer. I appreciate it. I know we have been continuing to have a number of conversations about, you know, the best way to implement this forward. I do still have some questions about a little bit of the framing of this. I know that LBO put out that note. They noted really specifically that, you know, it was really hard for them to be able to calculate costs or savings because there are anticipated savings as well with the law that we passed. And so I think you mentioned briefly that you guys had already calculated some costs based on the county. So I'd just like to know a little bit more about how you were able to do that and if you have any data on that. And then just kind of to reiterate again, too, that as you mentioned, like this is a pilot that is happening in Hennepin and Ramsey County that does have, would have the highest impact on the disproportionality of the families that we're seeing. And so, you know, they are anticipating to use a lot of the information that they find out over the next 2 years. There's a report that's actually going to be coming out earlier next year. We changed that. That was part of the language changes in the bill that became the law. So that way, you know, the additional counties could have that support that they needed, that security that they needed to be able to implement this. And so while I do agree that there are definitely needs in the technology that needs to be changed, and I think all of us would be on board with that because we want to make sure that we're all protecting our kids. All of our kids deserve protection. So I really would just, you know, as we're having these conversations, I would really want people to understand that data is coming, that we have that patience, to be able to really understand what both Hennepin and Ramsey are going to see and how that can be used across the state. I mean, we put that gap in there for a reason, and I think it would really behoove us to allow that information to come through before we start making any critical decisions one way or the other.
Thank you, Representative. Well, members, just a few brief comments. First, I want to thank Mr. Hilgart, Mr. Nissen, and the other presenters, Mr. Abdi and Ms. Goldman, for the information you presented today. Frankly, members, this is embarrassing. We as the state of Minnesota are doing a horrible job. This has been in existence for decades, and we should have taken care of this some time ago. I'm a veteran of MNLARS. I was deep into MNLARS when it happened. It was horrible. It was time-consuming, but it needed to be done. This is a similar situation. We have computer software that is inhibiting the ability of our workers to deliver the programs that we have endorsed. We're wasting time and money that should be spent taking care of people, not looking at the wheel of death on your computer. It's ridiculous. We need to fix this, and we need to fix it as soon as possible. I believe I see some bipartisan support for this effort. We need to get serious about this. We can't keep passing this off. We're doing a disservice to the people that need these services. We're doing a disservice to our counties. We're doing a disservice to the people that work in our counties. Who wants to go to work and spend 80% of your time staring at a computer screen when you'd rather be helping the people that need help? Let's take care of this. Members, this meeting is adjourned.